On this episode of Skeptico, naturalism.org's Tom Clark on the lack of evidence for the survival of consciousness after death.
You have to be agnostic about the possibilities for consciousness after death, especially my own particular personal consciousness with my characteristics, etc. So I can't disprove that that exists, but what's the positive evidence for that science has access to? I haven't seen a shred of positive evidence to support that belief, and that's how science works. In other words, we don't argue from gaps. We leave the gaps unfilled. We acknowledge that. But the reason I say I'm skeptical about, say, the existence of the soul or consciousness after death is precisely because there's no evidence for that.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris. Before we get started with today's interview with Tom Clark of naturalism.org, I wanted to take a minute and talk about something that seems to be coming up a lot lately, both in the new forums that we've started for Skeptico and in this interview with Tom Clark, and that's the issue of evidence. Evidence. Is there evidence of some of the claims of parapsychology? Is there evidence that consciousness survives death? Evidence, evidence, evidence. What you'll hear skeptics say, where's the evidence? This lacks evidence. If you guys just showed me the evidence, I'd believe you. You know, this just really strikes me as funny, and I had to take a minute and talk about it, because this is really what Skeptico has been all about from the beginning. Evidence. Finding the evidence. I saw the tussle between skeptics on one side and controversial researchers on the other, and I wanted to get to the bottom of it and find where the evidence is. So if you trace back through the Skeptico shows and look at how we've gone about looking for the evidence, some really interesting things emerge. Some of you who've been with Skeptico for a while will recall on the second show that we did, we interviewed Dean Radin. And I've repeated this story a couple times, but I'll repeat it one more time. You know, when I first talked to Dr. Radin, there were some pretty serious claims against the evidence that he had put forth for the existence of this presentiment effect, the ability that some people might have to be able to actually anticipate when something in the future is going to happen. Well, there were some very serious counterclaims against that raised by Dr. Ray Hyman, who is quite a well-known skeptic. So I went into this interview really not knowing whether Dr. Radin had any responses to this. If you remember, he had more than just responses. I mean, he completely refuted the claims of Ray Hyman. And he did it very effectively by citing published papers that he had done that totally countered his claims. So there's some evidence, but I want to take it further because one person's side of the story isn't enough. And I had two sides of the story, but I figured I should go back and get Ray Hyman's response. Ray Hyman wouldn't come on the show, wouldn't agree to be interviewed. So I followed through and went and talked to Steve Novella, host of Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, who had interviewed Ray Hyman. I asked him, hey, what about this? This seems to be a major contradiction in the evidence. Here's a guy who stated that the evidence isn't there when there's a published paper that shows the evidence is there. So Steve Novella, he's no dummy. He should know, right? No explanation. Gee, I don't know. Maybe Ray Hyman didn't read the paper, he said. Ridiculous. There's a guy, Ray Hyman, who said he's read more parapsychology papers than anybody, and he misses a major paper like this? Just not believable. But it's evidence. And when the evidence doesn't look the way you want it to, what's the first thing that a lot of people do? Ignore it. So evidence. More evidence. What's the next evidence we looked at on the show? Well, we looked at the work of Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. Now, to a lot of skeptics who don't know any better, even the name Rupert Sheldrake is this hot button of quackery. That's just totally ridiculous. Here's a guy whose academic record is stellar, top-notch, PhD Cambridge, published in Nature. I mean, the premier accomplishment for a biologist would be to publish a paper in Nature. Very few do it. very, very qualified guy and a smart guy if you listen to him. I think a reason a lot of the skeptics don't like him is he just doesn't back down. He doesn't apologize for what he's found. So what is his evidence? What we examined on this show was the evidence that some dogs seem to be able to tell when their owners are coming home. This evidence, of course, was refuted by Dr. Richard Wiseman, who was invited into the experiment, repeated the experiment, and the story goes that his data did not match Sheldrick's. But we went ahead and interviewed Richard Wiseman. And what did he reveal for the first time in 10 years? Well, he admitted, yes, his data did match Sheldrick's data. Now, he went on and still doesn't agree with Sheldrick's results. Of course, that's no surprise. And he didn't give any specifics for why he didn't agree with it. And also, no other skeptic has. I created open source science, detailed the experiment, the pros and the cons, the research methodology, the statistical considerations, invited any skeptics to come on and have a discussion. No one has been able to suggest any meaningful reason why the existing results should be called into question. And those results will be repeated. That's something we're going to follow up on. But until then, if you really are interested in evidence, then someone should be able to point out and say, hey, here seems to be an obvious flaw in this. Here's something that should be examined again. That's how evidence is treated. But a lot of times, it's not the way skeptics treat evidence. Instead, they either are ignorant of it or they dismiss it based on someone else's opinion. So that's what I'd really encourage anyone who's skeptical to do, is to really dig into the evidence. Dig into it yourself. You'd be surprised at what you might find. Okay. I guess I'll leave it there. And if we want to continue the discussion, I guess it'll go on in the forums, which are turning out to be pretty popular. So if you're interested in this kind of topic and you'd like to talk more about it, head on over to the forums. You'll see a link on the Skeptico website to forums and just click there and you'll have more dialogue than you probably would care to even read about all this. But now let's get on with the interview because it's a bit longer than usual and there's some really good parts at the end. So I want to give you a chance to hear the whole thing. Next up, Tom Clark, naturalism.org. Joined today by the author of a new book on naturalism titled Encountering Naturalism: A Worldview and Its Uses. And the book's author is definitely well qualified to write and speak with us today on the subject. Tom Clark is the founder and director of the Center for Naturalism in Massachusetts, and he's also the creator of naturalism.org, more or less the definitive source for information on this subject. He also lectures and writes on science topics, ethics, free will, and all sorts of related issues. Tom Clark, welcome to Skeptico.
Well, Alex, thank you very much for having me on. It's a pleasure to be here today.
You know, I'd like to start this the way I usually start these interviews, and I think it's always generates some interesting discussion, and that's what events or persons, insights, kind of sent you down this path of exploring naturalism?
Yeah, sure. I can tell you a little bit about that. I guess I got into naturalism actually through Eastern philosophy. I was an aficionado of someone called Alan Watts, who you may know. He was a prolific writer back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s who more or less translated the wisdom of the East for a Western audience. And I encountered his books and really liked them and found his approach to be very engaging and found the philosophy completely fascinating, his interpretations of Zen and whatnot. And what I found particularly striking was his criticism of the notion of the substantial self, right, the idea of ego, which comes up a lot in Alan Watts's writings, and of course, as you know, in Buddhism and Zen, the notion of self and ego is often brought into question through meditation practices. Anyway, having gotten interested in that, I then ran into Western philosophy, for instance, the work of Daniel Dennett, who's at Tufts University, who's now on the advisory board of the Center for Naturalism. And what I noticed was, and also B.F. Skinner, the behaviorist, who back in the 70s and 80s was also very much critiquing the idea of the self and free will. So what I noticed was that there was this parallel between Eastern and Western philosophy focused around the issues of self and agency. And so that led me to say, let's investigate the Western philosophical tradition. And what you find, of course, is that the Western philosophers, such as David Hume, and some of the Enlightenment philosophers, and more recently in modern philosophy, many of them are doing the same thing that Skinner, Alan Watts, the Buddhists did, which was to question the idea of human agency from a naturalistic standpoint. And so it was really the question of the issue of the self that got me interested in this, self and freedom and free will. And but then I discovered the broader domain of naturalism, which is really the critique of supernatural thinking. So that's kind of how, at least intellectually, I got into it. Of course, you know, there was some personal motivations as well. We all have our struggles, and I think that's kind of how I got interested in these things, is seeing what the, you know, what were the personal implications of the of all this stuff.
Great. Okay. No, I think that was, it's very interesting to hear that you kind of came at it from this westernized Zen perspective, Eastern perspective. That's interesting, and maybe we can touch on that later. And then how about naturalism.org, or we can even kind of skip over that, because that's really kind of self-explanatory to anyone who visits the site. It's very nice, has a ton of material that it links to, and you can explore all about naturalism. It lays it out with some basic definitions, frequently asked questions, all that stuff. But your new book, Encountering Naturalism, I think is interesting in that it doesn't start at that base level starting point, but kind of says, okay, we understand this perspective, naturalism, let's look at the implications of it. Is that more or less where you're heading with that?
Right. Well, I think the introduction and the first two chapters are sort of introduce naturalism as based in science. A naturalist would make a commitment to empirical, evidential knowledge as how to decide what exists. And if you do that, and you take essentially science as your way of knowing about things, then you're led to a naturalistic view of the world. And then the second chapter, or I should say chapter three, looks at it at human agency from the point of view of naturalism. So the first third of the book is kind of expository about what the basic epistemological grounds for naturalism, and then applying it to the self. I don't talk much about God because a lot of other books do that. So as I point out in the introduction, this is not a book about debunking deities, because a lot of Dennett and Harris and Hitchens and Dawkins have all done that. So this book really concentrates more on the self and free will issues as supernatural, potentially supernatural phenomena, depending on how you approach them. So, yeah. So after that kind of expository stuff, then you're right. The two-thirds of the book, perhaps more, is about getting into the implications, the personal and social implications, and existential implications of seeing ourselves as fully natural creatures, fully part of the natural world that science shows us.
Great. You know, I think that might be a good outline for our discussion today. Maybe we could start by talking about the basic tenets of naturalism and then move into this issue of the self and free will, which I find fascinating, and I think you do. I have to say, every time I think I have my arms around it, including the work that you've written, I get to a point and I go, aha, now I understand what they're talking about, and then it slips through my hands. So maybe we can overcome my weakness.
That experience, of course, is common to all of us, because depending on, you know, where you're at in your development, you're always going to find intellectual work or concepts or readings and writings that will be challenging. That's really true of everyone. So don't be discouraged. It happens to me all the time.
Well, it's the fun part of it too. It's also a signal to me that I'm growing. You know, because if it's too pat and it's too in line with everything that I already think, then it isn't challenging me. So.
Right, exactly. Well, I'm glad you found it challenging. That's good. I think a lot of people do, because they haven't fully taken in what a thoroughgoing naturalism is all about. Most of people listening to this perhaps have long since given up the idea of God. And that's that part of the supernatural realm. But I think a lot of people have yet to come to grips with what naturalism says about the human agent and
right.
who we are as persons.
Right. Okay, well, let's take a step back, and we have to address God at least a little bit because we're going to dance around it. But let's talk about naturalism. And here, I guess, is the big question I have, or the point that I can't quite resolve. You know, the quote from your website, you know, naturalism is the understanding that there's a single natural world as shown by science. Well, of course, it begs the question, what is science? I mean, science, of course, is a method. You know, it's not a body of knowledge. It's a body of knowledge that's always changing. And does that definition leave room for the fact that this body of knowledge is constantly changing and maybe changing in ways that move it away from some of the basic tenets of naturalism and materialism? And maybe you even want to also touch on how materialism is basically where we're left with when we have this naturalistic kind of view of things.
Well, naturalism and materialism are not coextensive. They refer to slightly different things. Naturalism, I think, as you started out by saying, really does commit to a science-based, evidence-based way of understanding reality. And it's the way a lot of philosophers think about naturalism is that philosophy is kind of continuous with science, with empirical investigation. So philosophy is not any longer the first science, as it's sometimes called. So if we go that route, and we're essentially empirically minded in how we decide what exists, we make that commitment to the scientific empirical method as how to have reliable knowledge about the world. If we make that commitment, then we go where science and we go where the latest clear, transparent explanations of phenomena go. And if those explanations show that there are two ultimate sorts of things in reality, then the naturalist would have to say, yeah, okay, our best ways of knowing, including philosophy and science, as sort of a continuum of investigation, have revealed to us that, what do you know, the universe is dualistic. Now, I don't think that science hasn't shown that yet, and philosophy has not shown that yet, to my satisfaction. But if it ever did, then the naturalist would have to accept that.
But how could you? I just have to interject there because that sounds good. But could you really incorporate that kind of dualistic view of consciousness into naturalism? I mean, one of the I don't want to call it a tenet. I should back off of that. But one of the statements, you know, we don't have souls that continue after death. You know, well, let's break down souls because it's kind of a highly charged religious term, and let's just say there isn't a continuity of consciousness after death.
Right.
And I'd say, do we really know that? Why don't I play a clip from a gentleman that I had on just a week or so ago, and is B. Alan Wallace is probably one of the preeminent Buddhist scholars in the United States, a Westerner who's translated many texts and was a Buddhist monk for 14 years, and has some very, in addition to having a PhD from Stanford, has some interesting things to say about consciousness. So if I could...
Sure. Bring it on. It'd be fun. I just want to mention that there are naturalists, philosophers like David Chalmers, who are dualists already. So that's how naturalism could conceivably differ from materialism, since some people think there might be two categorically different sorts of things coexisting in nature that are related by natural laws. So I just want to make sure the listeners understand that there's a difference between materialism, which asserts that the physical as defined by science is all there is, and naturalism, which is more open-minded and less dogmatic about what ultimately might be the case about the nature of things.
Very good distinction. I wasn't aware of that. Let me go ahead and play this, and we'll get your response.
And so we don't even know what's necessary for the generation of consciousness, whether you need a brain or whether a computer would be sufficient, nor do we know it's sufficient for the generation of consciousness. And so this is a massive amount of ignorance. Now, what can we say, since we know so little about the origins of consciousness in a human being? We don't know when it starts. We don't know whether it's taking place in the first, second, third trimester. We don't know when it ceases. How on earth can then, with confidence, can we say we know anything about what happens to consciousness at death with all of that ignorance?
Well, It seems to me his argument is that is essentially an argument from ignorance. Since we don't know so much about consciousness, therefore we can't make any claims at all about what we know. And I think that's false. The inference is false. We know a lot about consciousness. We know, for instance, that it's always correlated with events in the brain, as far as science can tell. There's never been an exception to that as far as mainstream, intersubjective, peer-reviewed, journal-published science has shown. We find consciousness always correlated with neural events in ourselves and presumably other species. So, therefore, there's very little reason or evidence to suggest that consciousness continues independent of activity in the brain, which means that after you're dead, that particular consciousness most likely doesn't exist any longer.
See, but I think you could take that argument of ignorance and turn it around, and I think that that's what he's really saying, is the naturalism point of view that you espouse fills in those gaps of ignorance with one belief system. And he's saying, you know, there's really another belief system that we could fill it with. So in light of that, why don't we not fill it with either one and take a purely scientific view and say, we don't know.
Right. Well,
let me just, because I want to comment on
sure.
the other half of what you said. So we say, naturalism states, we do not have souls that continue after death. And Dr. Wallace is saying, we do not know that. And then the second part is to say, really, what some scientific studies, peer-reviewed, carefully done, are telling us is that we're challenging that notion that there can be no conscious experience independent of what's happening with the biology and chemistry of our brain after death. There's many documented cases of this. There's many good studies, the Lancet study that everyone always talks to, refers to by von Lommel, long-term, published in one of the most respected medical journals, seriously calls into question any kind of alternative explanation we could have for what's happening after people die. We have other studies, again, carefully done studies by very well-qualified researchers that shows that a significant number of people after they die are able to recount the resuscitation experience and are able to do it much more accurately than a control group. Now, near-death experience, again, I've been talking about this for a few weeks. I have to say, it's not my area of expertise. It's not my hot button. It just so happens that I think more than anything else, it really brings to a head, to focus, this idea of, one, how little we know about consciousness, and two, how incredibly plausible it is that a completely different understanding of consciousness exists. And I come back to that point. Aren't you filling in that gap, that ignorance that you kind of called Dr. Wallace on? Aren't you filling it in as well and saying we already know something that science really hasn't proven?
Well, how do we make knowledge claims? We make them on the basis of positive evidence. So, strictly speaking, I'd have to be agnostic about the possibilities for consciousness after death, especially my own particular personal consciousness with my characteristics, etc. So I can't disprove that that exists, but what's the positive evidence for that science has access to? I haven't seen a shred of positive evidence to support that belief, and that's how science works. In other words, we don't argue from gaps. We leave the gaps unfilled. We acknowledge that. But the reason I say I'm skeptical about, say, the existence of the soul or consciousness after death is precisely because there's no evidence for that. It's the same argument against God. I can't disprove that God exists, but there's no positive evidence. Therefore, as a person who has to have a certain number of beliefs, I pick those beliefs that have positive evidence for them, and I don't put stock or waste time with assuming that something might exist for which there isn't any evidence, and that's how I would respond. The other ways of knowing that people sometimes use to back up this, what you said, I think was another plausible way of looking at this. If they're in competition with science, I want to know what they are. I want to know how reliable their results are, whether they can predict and control anything like the way scientific results can. So that's where that would be my response.
See, and I think there's there's some points that you've made there that I think are perfectly valid. And let me fine-tune where I'm coming from, because I'm not coming from a religious perspective. I'm not trying to stick Jesus in the mix or Allah in the mix. What I'm coming from the perspective is that there's a lot of work being done on the cutting edge that's very good work, that's pointing in another direction, and yet there's a group, and I think the group that you represent, who are skeptics and naturalist, materialist, and I don't want to lump them all together, because as you point out, there's different viewpoints and different issues there, but I think that they collectively kind of really hold back opening up to what might be happening,
right,
not what is happening.
Exactly, so, they do hold back. Because if we open ourselves up to what might be happening without a lot of evidence to support that opening up, we'd be going down a lot of blind alleys. So it isn't that we're being...
No, that's that old argument. I mean, that just doesn't... I mean, I talked to... So a couple of weeks ago, I talked to Dr. Ed Kelly and Dr. Emily Kelly, both at the University of Virginia. The guy's a Yale graduate, PhD, Harvard. She's well-qualified, PhD, Virginia. I mean, so they just wrote this book, Irreducible Mind, chronicling, you know, all this evidence accumulated through all these studies, tying it together. You got Davidson up at Wisconsin doing work with the Buddhist monks. You have all these people. You stitch it together, and I'm not saying, you know, oh, here is the solid proven case, but I'm saying to be dismissive in saying, oh, the evidence isn't enough. The evidence. I think you just have to deal with the evidence as it comes, rather than have this position that we're somehow a watchguard. We're the protectors of the crucible of science. There is no crucible of science. I mean, it's just always changing. The whole issue with materialism, I mean, that just confounds me, is matter, as we understand it, has been a moving target for hundreds of years.
Right, but the scientific method has not been a moving target. It's gradually refined.
Exactly.
So that's where you have to place your bets, is with this method and scientific peer review and constructing the clearest, most transparent, most parsimonious explanations of phenomena that you can get. Now, if all the people you were citing with the PhDs, et cetera, buy into that, and if their papers are methodologically sound and their results can be reproduced, and their concepts are fleshed out, not fuzzy, then they're doing good science. I have no complaint whatsoever. If they can shift the paradigm where something like a soul or something immaterial that instantiates specific personalities, people like you and me with all our characteristics and foibles and desires and whatnot, if they show that that's the case, they're going to get Nobel Prizes one after the other. And it would be fantastic. What a revelation. But I am not holding my breath, because I haven't seen, and I'm not as well read as you are in this domain, clearly. And that may be a fault of mine, perhaps. But until I see something in Science and Nature, those magazines, saying what the proof of the pudding here, showing that it's really something that mainstream science is really on board with, then I'm not going to waste cognitive resources worrying about it.
Okay, and I understand. I understand that position. Let's get back to talking about naturalism, because I don't want to get too far afield and bring up all these other topics that you have no reason to spend, as you say, your cognitive.
Well, no, they interest me as examples of scientific method of what a naturalist, as I conceive her to be, would how she would approach these problems. I see the real critical issue that defines a naturalist is someone who's interested in transparent explanations given intersubjective evidence. And what I see anti-naturalists doing much of the time is having prior ontological commitments to something that they think should or must exist to make life meaningful, for instance, the soul or life after death. And then they scramble around trying to find any shred of empirical evidence to back it up. The naturalist approach is to let the ontology be driven by the investigation. And that's what responsible dualists like David Chalmers do. He's a terrific philosopher. He's into the science. I think he's wrong, but he's being, completely strict in his adherence to good science and good philosophy. So, and I think a lot of anti-naturalists are not really being methodologically scrupulous in how they address either the method, the way of knowing, or evidence.
Well, and I think that that's where your argument is really strongest, and I'm in complete agreement with it. And it's really kind of the secularism. It comes through in that we have to combat ignorance disguised as knowledge, and I'm totally supportive of that, and I'm supportive of what you said. I may be drawing out a subtle distinction as we get over on this other side, and that's that, you know, science is not value-free, and the scientific method isn't applied equally across the board, which really kind of gets to the second clip from B. Allen Wallace that I wanted to play and maybe get a response to, and then I thought maybe we could move into free will.
Sure, sounds good. This is what bothers me about many of the so-called skeptics. What they're doing is defending the status quo, which doesn't take a whole lot of guts, frankly. They're about as skeptical as Pat Robertson or Billy Graham. They, too, have their congregation behind them. They all agree, and they're skeptical of other religions. They're skeptical of materialism and so forth and so on. I just don't see much difference in the skepticism of a religious fundamentalist than I do the skepticism of a hardcore, committed scientific materialist.
Okay, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so he's faulting Salfay, the naturalist, for not being sufficiently skeptical. But what's the target of skepticism there? Is it the method of inquiry, or is it the conclusions about the world that we're led to if we stick with science? We should and can be skeptical of everything. Of course, not all at once, because you have to operate from some provisional base of method or assumptions. So, yeah, we want to be cognizant of how we decide what's true, and scientists are always checking their data against each other and the natural world, and that's why reproducible results are the sine qua non of holding your beliefs reliably. And so I think scientists, that he thinks are not insufficiently skeptical, are arch skeptics, because they're always trying to poke holes in each other's results. It's a community of mutual detractors who are all trying to show that the other guy isn't right. So I think science has built into it a highly skeptical mechanism. So I think he's wrong about that. And as far as the status quo is concerned, well, what's the status quo in science? The status quo is hardly ever fixed. Theories are always being challenged. Scientific method itself, due to the philosophy of science, is always being challenged. The philosophers are trying to say, well, what's really going on in scientific methodology? So it's always being critiqued. So I flatly disagree with that assessment.
Okay. We'll pretty much leave it there then, and let's go on and talk about free will. You know, no, actually, let me go back. I can't quite leave it there.
That's why, don't.
You know, one of the things we've explored on the show is this issue of value-free science, and that science isn't value-free, and the choices we make about the studies that we do, the studies that we don't do, who we respond to, who we shout down, have a huge bearing. And I think that you live that and experience that because you are so often find yourself in conflict with fundamentalist Christians who are either peddling a creationist view or peddling a hardcore intelligent design view. And they have the resources to do that. And they have a certain degree, they have the microphone to do that because we live in a society that's very Christian in its tradition. So I think you've experienced that already. As I move in and talk to people in the controversial areas of science who are real scientists, who are really doing the work, and in many cases do not have an axe to grind. You know, I talked to Dean Radin, who's very well known in the parapsychology circles and is a target for these skeptics all the time. You talk to that guy, He's much more of a materialist, naturalist, atheist kind of person. But of course, that can never come out, because as soon as he says, hey, my investigations show that maybe we need to call into question some of these fundamental notions that we have about a materialistic view of things, he's immediately shouted down by these hardcore skeptics. I think B. Allen Wallace is responding to that because he's experienced that too. Whenever he has anything to say, there's this small group of dogmatic skeptics that just, I've experienced them now, they just act just like fundamentalist Christians. Same. They don't want to hear anything. It always has to come back to, I mean, you've been more open to saying, hey, maybe it could be this way, maybe it could be that way. It always comes back to, for these people too, it can't be any different than the way that I already know it.
Well, of course, that is a dogmatic attitude, and I wouldn't endorse it. But on the other hand, the skeptics have every right to put Wallace, Radin, and the other fringe science, as I would call them, folks, they have every right to call those fringe science claims into question. And
no, they don't.
Yes, they do. That's the project of science. That's how science works.
Here's my disagreement with that. It's because the practical aspects of that are not that. It's what they wind up doing is suppressing any work. You know, that's the part I really call into question. The gatekeepers are already in place. You don't get a university degree unless you're somewhat well qualified. That doesn't mean that everyone who gets a PhD is at the same level, but that's a certain gatekeeper. You don't publish in a peer-reviewed journal unless you meet certain criteria. And then you'll hear some of these skeptics say, well, which journal? Well, I'd like to see some of those people who are critical try and publish in the Journal of Scientific Exploration and look at the editorial board and look at the people across the board, across the United States, in all these universities. These aren't chumps that you're just going to pass some crappy paper passed, and yet that's the impression that's often left. I think we may need to make a distinction, and I think the same distinction needs to be made in the naturalism worldview, to not fill these gaps, to say we have these gaps, and there's people who are exploring these gaps and coming up with a lot of different conclusions than is maintained by the mainstream. Because if we only go with the mainstream, whether it's mainstream science or mainstream religion, it's really not a very interesting discussion.
Right, but I think the mainstream that we're talking about is a methodological mainstream. And the fringe science folks, as far as I can tell, are not methodologically sound.
To directly refute that, and then I'll get off it, the real data that's been analyzed in terms of how studies are done, parapsychologists are the most stringent of any of the sciences, more double blind and more in keeping with the most stringent criteria, because they're the most attacked, of course. So no, really, that's not my reading of it, I guess I should say.
Right. But again, not to be dogmatic is important. And I think if the parapsychologists and the fringe scientists have a paradigm shift under their belts, and it finally comes to fruition, more power to them. The proof ultimately is in the pudding. The gatekeepers, yes, there are dogmatic gatekeepers who will try to shout people down, but if the research has been methodologically sound, if they're reproducible, and if they're at a certain minimum statistical level of significance, then they have to be admitted. And if they are, more power to them, because the science really isn't dogmatic in terms of the picture of the world it constructs. It can't be. That's its whole raison d'etre, is to be self-correcting. So to the extent that people are being unfairly excluded from mainstream science, that's wrong. But I frankly don't see that they're being unfairly excluded in many cases. But we could have this argument indefinitely, probably.
Right, and I will leave you with the last word, because I almost did it last time, and I will this time.
Oh, no problem.
Okay, I wanted to go on and talk about free will, because it's a very, very interesting and at the same time challenging subject. Let me read, if I can, a quote from your writings and then get you to kind of expound on that.
Okay.
We don't have free will in the sense of being able to choose or decide. We couldn't have done otherwise in the circumstances we were in. Okay, so that's basically...
Where did that quote come from?
From your website. And you know what? Let me correct that and say, not directly from your book, I apologize. And if there's anything that isn't quite correct there, please...
I wouldn't agree with that, because we do choose and decide. It's just our choosing and deciding doesn't involve a supernatural power of choice or decision making.
Well, then let me back up and just say, how do you see and understand free will? How do you explain it to people in your book and the implications of it?
Yeah, well, we have to be very clear about what we mean by free will. We have to define it carefully, and that's what I do in, I think it's chapter 3, which is about who are we, where I talk about human agency and free will. And so what is free will? Well, there are different definitions floating around, and we have to be clear about which definition we have in mind when we're talking about it. One definition of free will is simply the freedom to act voluntarily according to my desires. I get to do what I want. No one's preventing me from acting on my desires as they occur to me. That kind of freedom is often called free will. I say I got married of my own free will. This is an example I use in the book, which I did. I got married voluntarily. I wanted to get married. No one was holding a gun to my head. And that's an important kind of free will to have. But that kind of free will is perfectly compatible with all of my desires being determined and caused by circumstances that ultimately I had no control over. In other words, my character, my physical being, my desires and motives all ultimately stem from environments and genetic endowments that existed before I was born. So we can trace back the causal story in time of why I wanted to get married. So that kind of freedom, the voluntary choice to get married, that kind of free will is compatible with determinism, the law-like cause and effect relationship between various events in the world as science describes it. So that's one kind of free will. And everyone has that kind of free will or freedom just so long as they live in an open society where they're not being coerced to do things they don't want to do. So it's an uncontroversial kind of free will, right?
Okay.
That's one kind of free will. We all have it, if we're lucky. A lot of people living in totalitarian societies can't do what they want all the time, so they don't have that much. They don't have as much of that kind of freedom. Another kind of free will, the kind that I deny exists, I call contra-causal free will. And a lot of people think they have this kind of free will, but I think they're wrong. Contra-causal free will is the ability to choose a course of action or to make a choice or make a decision without your decision being the fully caused result of conditions in the environment and your physical being. In other words, another way to think about this is I have this kind of contra-causal free will just insofar as I could have done otherwise in a particular situation, even if that situation were exactly like it was when I made the original decision. It's a strong sense of could have done otherwise that, from a naturalistic standpoint, doesn't exist.
And what about, and here's where it gets a little bit hard to kind of grapple with, and that's we bring it down to a practical application. And I think I've heard you mention before, correct me again if I'm wrong, but in terms of this worldview being applied to someone who's overweight mm-hmm. and wants to lose weight, well, then your recommendation would be change your environment, stop watching ads on TV for the foods that you love so much because those are what are causing you to have right. this something along those lines?
Yeah. You look at the world as an if-then situation, hypothetically. You say, if I did X, what would be the result? And so you say, well, if I turn off the television and don't expose myself to junk food advertising, then I'll be less likely to want it. So you're changing your environment in a way that you know will most likely help you lose weight. So it isn't a matter of willpower, except, of course, you start off with the desire to lose weight. That has to be there. But given that you want to lose weight, then you don't suppose that you can simply bootstrap yourself to losing weight. You have to get smart and say, what causes me to keep my weight on? What causes me to desire food more than I should? What causes me to consume more food than I want? So you look at the causal situation behind your obesity very carefully and then modify your behavior such that, or your environment, you change your environment or your behavior or both in ways that make it far more likely that you'll lose weight.
So that's the part where I get confused. I mean, as you start unraveling the causes, I mean, who decides to turn off the TV? How is that? Who gets the willpower to turn off the TV? Not who, but I mean, I'm sorry, yeah. A ghost in the machine. Or when you said you can change your behavior, well, how would you change your behavior if you don't have free will?
Right. Again, this is the idea of free will as being somehow something independent of causation. This is the contra-causal conception of free will that's operating in your question, right?
Well, so, I was just picking up your answer. I mean, so yeah. in your example, who is getting the – how is the willpower to generate – how is the decision – I don't want to put any charged words in there unnecessarily. How is the decision to turn off the TV and go read a book made? How is the decision
– Well, how is it made? How does any decision happen? It's the result of a certain number of factors. In this case, one of the factors is you've learned that turning off the television might have the effect of allowing you to lose weight. So, given your original desire to lose weight, this is a good reason for you to turn off the television, and that's how the decision gets made. You don't have to posit free will to make that happen. In fact, any kind of free will that was independent of causation wouldn't do you any good at all because it wouldn't be influenced by anything. So the decision-making capacities, the choices that we make, all of that is a function of conditions. And what I'm doing in pointing out the fact we don't have free will is to make us more cognizant of the conditions that actually determine behavior. And that gives us more power because we'll have more control. So it's important to see that having contra-causal free will, some kind of uncaused vantage point from which to choose, wouldn't do you any good at all because you'd have no basis on which to make the choice, whereas looking at it causally shows you the basis for your choices. I want to lose weight. If I turn off the television, if I don't go to the store, I'm more likely not to gain weight. Therefore, the choice arises deterministically to turn off the TV set and not go to the store.
Okay. I think that the problem that I have and a lot of folks have is not the idea that it's that there's a nature component of it, that there's a strong genetic component of it, or that there's a strong environmental component of it. It's the absoluteness of it, the fact that there is no space in there for any kind of decision.
No. See, that's not the case. You still make decisions. You're a decision-making machine, as a matter of fact. So it's not as if decisions don't get made. They do get made. It's just we understand clearly the factors that go into making a decision. And again, it's really important to see that if you stood at the center of the storm with all your desires swirling about you but were unaffected by your desires and could simply choose which to go with and which not to go with, you wouldn't have any basis to decide which desire to go with. You have to have a desire to motivate you. And that has nothing to do with free will, which is why I think it was either Schopenhauer or someone else who said, we can choose to do what we want, but we can't choose to want what we want. And the reason you can't is you have to have an antecedent desire in order to know what you're going to do next. So the very idea of a contra-causal free will is really incoherent. It doesn't get you anywhere.
Right. Well, isn't that also predicated on this dualism argument that we were talking about earlier, right? I mean, if, as you stated, mind equals brain, and that everything that is happening, everything that is our conscious experience is reducible to our biology, then I see your point. If it's not, then I think it opens up some interesting possibilities. But let's get it back to a scientific analysis of that and free will. You know, one of the areas that interests me is the whole idea of neuroplasticity. And if you apply that to what's going on in contemplative sciences, and we heard the clips from Dr. Wallace, who's a Buddhist and was a Buddhist monk and lived in, you know, the caves of India like you hear about and only had his food brought up once a week. And so these people who deeply, deeply go into the contemplative science of studying their mind, well, one of the things we know scientifically is that when they come out and we look at their brains, we do scan, we do an fMRI, their brains are different. And we understand that now through the neuroscience of neuroplasticity, we understand a little bit how that's done. But doesn't that kind of call into question, if we are able with our intention, with our thought, to change the physiology that is our brain, doesn't that kind of call into question what role that intention, that consciousness plays in this whole act that we're playing out?
Well, you're assuming that somehow the consciousness and intention is something other than the brain doing its thing, and that's, of course, the fundamental issue that's at question. So you're kind of begging that question when you say that the consciousness causes the brain to change. It's actually, from my standpoint, a physicalist, naturalist standpoint, it's the brain changing itself. Because the very thought and very intention that you go in with is a matter of what the brain does. So,
well, then we get in, but don't we kind of get into a circular kind of issue of semantics? Because this idea of intention is really something that doesn't easily fall into the materialistic kind of view of things. It's much more analogous to what we see in quantum physics with the observer effect, which we have no way of kind of really understanding. But this idea of intention is not something that fits into materialism easily.
Well, that's a very strong claim, and it's an empirical matter. It's a theoretical matter that people working in consciousness studies are working on very hard. They're trying to come up with naturalistic theories of intention, which could show, in fact, that, yeah, the brain can instantiate intentionality. And the brain is a physical organ. It's all material particles and neurons and whatnot connected together in very complicated ways that can instantiate beliefs and desires, intentional phenomena. And of course, we can't understand them at the level of those phenomena at the level of atoms and molecules and neurons, but there's no reason to think that they are not fully physically instantiated. And that's to say that materialism or naturalism can't account for intention is to really beg the question. It's an open question of how it's done. Of course, that's the research agenda of consciousness studies is to try to naturalize these things. But to say up front that they are simply not material phenomena is to already have decided the question.
Your point's well taken, and I have to back off of that somewhat. But it does go back to the same point of we're both trying to fill in the gaps, and I do have to say that the gaps that we're talking about there of intention fit much better with an alternative paradigm that sees the mind as this receiver, or the brain as this receiver of consciousness, rather than this generator of consciousness.
Right, but what kind of mechanism then interposes or translates between the physical brain and the immaterial mind? As far as I know, there's no mechanism proposed, and if such a mechanism were shown, it would tend to unite the physical and mental into a single naturalistic worldview. So,
and I'd be fine with that.
I'd be fine with it too. The question, though, is there any hard evidence that that consciousness researchers and neuroscientists have come up with that there's something immaterial, for instance, an immaterial intention that somehow changes the brain? To me, that's a non-starter because I haven't seen any evidence to suggest there is such a thing. Moreover, the mechanism is completely obscure, weren't shown to exist. And as the story gets filled in, there's a gap there. I agree. We both agree there's a gap in our understanding. But as the story gets filled in, what will that do? It will create a unified understanding, what we call a scientific understanding of how this all works. But from where I sit, neuroplasticity is best understood as neurons, the brain, changing themselves. It's a monistic, non-dualistic bet about what's going on with intention, that it ultimately is physically instantiated. Now, I know that's hard for a lot of people to realize, but there are people doing theoretical work that makes this not so implausible. A guy named Thomas Metzinger has written a fantastic book called Being No One. He's a German fellow. Very elaborate and, I think, fairly convincing argument about consciousness and how, on a representational understanding, we could get a handle on things like neuroplasticity.
Okay, well, that's an interesting reference, and I think we're certainly in agreement that if anything, we should call for more and more and more work in this area, because it's really where we're going to get the breakthroughs, in one way or another, either on a materialistic side or towards another paradigm that kind of.
But I just want to here's the point, though. I think we can agree. I hope we can agree that the paradigm will be naturalistic, in the sense that there's going to be nothing spooky going on. There won't be any hand waving. There won't be any gesturing towards things that are not clearly defined. It'll all be nailed down, right?
Well.
I mean, otherwise we don't have a good explanation. And this is where I think we really have to be clear, because I see the fringe scientists not defining their concepts clearly, not having methodological rigor. So if you're going to call a worldview, if you're going to call a result naturalistic in the where I'm coming from, everything has to be nailed down. If it gets us to a kind of dualism, that's fine. I don't care. I don't care what the ontology
is. The process of getting us to where everything is nailed down is a long process, and we don't know where it's going. That's not the nature of science to say, okay, I'll agree with you when you get everything nailed down. I'll tell you what, everything isn't nailed down now. It never has been nailed down, and it will never be nailed down.
Oh, fine.
And you know, we skipped over, like before, when you said, you know, when you give me the evidence, when you show me the evidence, it's the oldest argument in the book, and everybody on both sides said that. Okay, I'm going to talk to a fundamentalist Christian tomorrow. Sounds like a very nice guy, well-educated guy, and you know, you listen to those guys past the people who are really not that smart. You listen to ones who are really smart. They have good arguments too, and he's going to say the same thing, right? I'm going to come at it from the perspective of where I'm at, that science really has to be the way of knowing. And he's going to say, hey, I'm all for that. I know what he's going to say, right? You know what he's going to say.
Right.
I'm all for that. As soon as you show me conclusively, I will believe. And of course, that's just a smokescreen. So when I tell you that there's been studies published in The Lancet, one of the top three medical journals in the world, English language medical journals in the world, that show that people have a cardiac arrest, and within 11 seconds after they have cardiac arrest, their EEG stops, and yet these people are able to have these complex mental cognitive functioning in their brain that is this near-death experience. And we have no way of explaining that in our conventional idea of how the brain works. And yet that isn't evidence to say, okay, stop. Before I go any further, I need to stop and really understand that. Or when I tell you that there's good, solid evidence done in again, hospital settings, controlled studies, where we say, you know, people who are able to recount the resuscitation process, which in a hospital is very complex. So you get the control group, and they're basically saying this stuff that they see on ER about how the resuscitator went. And they're not able to do it well at all. And then you take the people who had an out-of-body experience as a part of their near-death experience, and they're able to, on a statistical basis, much more accurately report that. Why aren't you saying, stop. Okay, I need to back off, and until I can really incorporate that into my existing worldview, I really can't go any further.
Right.
But instead, what I hear is, you know what? I'll know it when I believe it.
Right. Well, my point would be, I don't believe anything on insufficient evidence. I'm agnostic, as I said earlier, that we do have to have hard evidence, replicable studies about what the mechanisms are, what's really transpiring that could explain these experiences. I agree with you. But that cuts both ways. I don't think the alternative hypothesis that there's something immaterial going on, it does any explanatory work at all. So by the same reasoning, you too should not be jumping to any conclusion that's dualistic.
I completely agree. And
okay.
That is really my point. You know, the one part you said in there that I would slightly disagree is we do not have to come up with a theory to explain the phenomena, fully explain the phenomena that we see. We don't have to come up with that theory in order to say the existing paradigm that we have is not working, does not fit. And again, it just strikes me that where that always happens, where science always progresses, is at the anomalies, at the cases that fall outside the range of what we normally experience. And we're just not looking at those enough. We're not taking enough serious attention to them as they would relate to this existing paradigm that we have about consciousness and about how the brain works.
Well, that's an interesting claim that you say we're not paying enough attention to them. People have tried to pay a lot of attention to them. Bring them in. Susan Blackmore she's on our advisory board for the Center for Naturalism, and she, as you know, was a parapsychologist for a long time, believed strong in these phenomena, and did a lot of investigation, and ultimately changed her mind about
that. Yeah, I just don't find her that persuasive at all. We had her on the show. Very nice.
Yep. Well, I think we're kind of at an impasse because if you think the current paradigm really is inadequate, I want to say, well, on what basis? And you're going to say to me, well, they haven't been able to explain this phenomena. And I say, yep, that's true, they haven't. Then I'll ask you, well, what's your alternative explanation? And how does it connect to the rest of science? If you can connect it to the rest of science, then you're doing science. If you can't, then you're kind of off in this quasi-scientific fringe science land, and whether that will join up with regular science is an open question. It may or may not. But if it does join up with mainstream science, it won't be fringe any longer. It won't be paranormal. It'll be normal. So people who are doing paranormal research who really want to be taken seriously, they should be careful what they want, because they'll get absorbed into mainstream science if what they have to say is true.
Right.
And
well,
that's not what they want. Most people who dabble in the paranormal and the mystical, who think that intention and desire is immaterial, don't want science to be right. That's why they're in the paranormal and fringe science to begin with. They want something more than materialism and naturalism. So as soon as they're proven right, they will be disappointed because it'll be absorbed into the single worldview that is science, which after all is what naturalism is. So
yeah, I think we're talking about two different groups there. And that's really been my motivation in doing the Skeptico show. You know, when I talk to Dean Radin, he doesn't want it to be fringe.
Oh, okay, good. If I can hear that.
We talked to Ed and Emily Kelly or Gary Schwartz or Rupert Sheldrick or any of the top people who are in universities and are holding on to a university job.
Yep.
They don't have any interest in running around and doing ghost hunting and holding seances and all the rest of this. They're just trying to follow the data like everyone else.
Fair enough. So, that's good. Then I have no complaint about them. If that's really what they're doing, then... But I can tell you a lot of their followers, I think, would be sorely disappointed if it turns out that telepathy, for instance, turned out to be real and was physically explicable. Well, that would be a big disappointment, because what would that mean? It would mean there would be a material, natural explanation for something they were hoping was paranormal. Now,
well, I think that it gets into semantics, and it's the whole idea of, as you point out in kind of naturalism, I mean, anything that as soon as we understand the mechanism for it, and it kind of comes out of the supernatural realm, and it
right.
becomes down to the natural
exactly.
realm.
Exactly, exactly.
But we can have, in that natural realm, we can have a completely different understanding of consciousness and consciousness survive. I mean, consciousness surviving our bodily death would take a pretty different spin on things.
Yes, it would. You're right. It would be a revolution in a naturalistic understanding of ourselves. If that revolution comes to pass, if it's validated scientifically, and it gets published in peer-reviewed journals and all of that, then I'd be right there with the rest of you. For some reason, I'm skeptical that will happen, but should it happen, the naturalist will accept it because it's methodologically sound. That's the only thing that matters, is that you arrive at knowledge using the most reliable... you arrive at beliefs using the most reliable method of verifying knowledge that we've got, and that's intersubjective, peer-reviewed, reproducible experimental science.
Finally, something we can both completely agree.
All right, we did it.
Okay.
Fantastic.
So again, Tom, thanks again for joining us. The book for everyone is Encountering Naturalism: A Worldview and Its Uses, and it not only explores the origins and definitions of naturalism, but then what are the implications, which we really didn't get a chance to talk about too much, but maybe you can imagine that if you apply those ideas of free will to our legal system, to our system of government, the implications are quite far-reaching. And I think it's a very brave book for you to write and kind of come out, because the conclusions are not popular, will not be popular, I think, for a lot of folks, skeptical people, as well as certainly non-skeptical people.
Well, yeah, I try to show that they're progressive humanistic conclusions, actually. I think it'll appeal to about half of the people out there, if as long as they can swallow the bit about no free will. If you can swallow that, then I think the progressives out there should like the conclusions, because what I try to show is that this understanding of ourselves makes us more compassionate, because we see that we're not self-created, that people don't create themselves as evildoers, for instance. Makes us more humble, because we don't create ourselves. We're fully caused to be who we are. And it makes us more effective, because as we talked about earlier, we understand why we do what we do. So compassion and control come from seeing our connection, our full, complete connection to the natural world.
Great. Well said.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I really enjoyed talking with you, Alex. It was a nice discussion. I admire your dogged, not dogmatic, but but dogged persistence in holding up the what I would call fringe science, and you know, you may be right. I mean, that's what the undogmatic part of me has to say.
Well, you know, the part I feel, just to make a final note here, but the part I feel very, very confident that I know I'm right on, and because I started this show by reading. Like going on Wikipedia and reading some of the just terrible kind of personal attacks that these scientists, I'm not talking about the people who we would all agree are not scientists and are not doing things the right way, but scientists who dare to delve into and question this existing paradigm, and they're just ridiculed, and they're just basically kind of run out of town on a rail. And that really got me, because I said, that's not the way that science is supposed to work. Science is not a blood sport where you shout down anyone who has an opposing view. And it just amazes me that people in the skeptical community don't see, as we were saying, you know, that they are just, in that respect, they're just putting a nice spin on being dogmatic, in the same way that the fundamentalist Christians are, the people that they most oppose in their worldview. So, We have the discussion, and I certainly enjoyed it with you. You're very, very, very obviously well-spoken on this topic, and I think that anyone will get a lot out of visiting naturalism.org. There's a lot to think about there, and your writings are really, really great on the topic.
Well, thanks, Alex. I certainly appreciate the kind words, and thanks very much for having me on the show.
If you'd like more information about Tom's book or a link to his website, please check out the Skeptico show notes at skeptiko.com. You'll also find links to all our archived old shows, links to the forum section, and a place where you can get my email address and drop me a note and tell me what you think of the show. That's going to about do it for today. Thanks for joining us. Bye for now.